10:30 having arrived, pursuant to House Rule 10.01, I'm calling this remote meeting of the House Preventing Homelessness Division to order. The clerk will take the roll to determine which members are present.
Chair Gomez.
Present.
Gomez present. Keeler.
Keeler present.
Keeler present. New Brindley.
Present.
New Brindley present. Davids.
Davids present.
Davids present. Heinrich.
Heinrich present.
Heinrich present. Hollins.
Hollins present.
Hollins present. Hornstein.
Hornstein present.
Hornstein present. Howard.
Howard present.
Howard present. Cagle.
Present.
Cagle present. Petersburg.
Present.
Petersburg present. Ryer.
Present.
Ryer present. And we do have a quorum.
Thank you, Mr. Clerk. Next up, can I have a motion from a committee member to approve the minutes for March 10th, 2021?
So moved.
Representative Cagle moves approval of the minutes for March 10th, 2021. Is there any discussion on the motion? Hearing none, if we could unmute for a second, we're going to take a voice vote. All those in favor, please say aye.
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 Any opposed? The motion prevails and the minutes for March 10th, 2021 are adopted. So welcome to the committee, everyone. We're really pleased and lucky to have some of our local partners here today. You know, as we've done our work and we're trying to, you know, collectively kind of get our arms around the state's homelessness response, we know that some of our most important allies and people who really much more than the state agency are on the front line of delivering services to our unhoused members of our community, our local partners. And so, you know, so today we're going to get some perspective from officials who represent cities and counties across the state. I just wanted to say at the outset, we have folks from Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis counties, which, as we've kind of been discussing, are sort of the places where I believe, or my understanding kind of from talking to folks, is that there's the most, because they're some of the more populous counties, the most well-developed emergency shelter responses. Our intention originally was we were having an official from Clay County coming to share their experience also. They're not able to join us today. And so I think this conversation is going to be really good for us, but I also see the need to kind of bring some perspective from some of those smaller counties that maybe don't have the resources that Hennepin, Ramsey, and St. Louis do at a future date. So I just wanted to mention that for community members before we dig in, that, you know, it was sort of our intention to get a little bit broader of a perspective, but we're looking forward to continuing this conversation. So first up, we're going to hear from our partners here in St. Paul and Ramsey County. So Ramsey County and, Deputy Mayor Jamie Tincher from St. Paul and Commissioner Jim McDonough have joined us, and they're going to be walking us through their coordinated response to the unsheltered homelessness crisis and, you know, the complications they faced during COVID-19 and what that response has been like. And so welcome to the committee. We're really pleased to have you here. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair Gomez and committee members. We appreciate this opportunity. I just wanted to quickly comment on a couple of your opening remarks. I'm very active in the State Association of Counties, and homelessness, sheltered and unsheltered populations are prevalent throughout the state. It is not just an urban issue. It's larger, it's all relative, and the issues around the unsheltered and sheltered homelessness population in Minneapolis and St. Paul, Ramsey and Hennepin, St. Louis, Homestead, certainly are larger, but our smaller counties are dealing with this also, and it does depend on that strength and partnership. And hopefully today's presentation with the deputy mayor and I will give you a sense of that strong partnership that we have locally, and then help you as we move forward together here in realizing and supporting that partnership at the state level. We're going to provide you a brief history on how we approach this work together prior to the pandemic. review the challenges that COVID-19 created for our residents experiencing homelessness and the impacts to our programming and services available to support them. Go over the strategies we pursued to address the needs and our plans for future work. Our challenge last year was that we needed to act very quickly to have additional capacity before the cold weather arrived and before COVID relief funding expired on December 31st, 2020. Our opportunity was that we had a new funding that we could invest in long-term strategic ways that would serve our residents experiencing homelessness, not just through the COVID pandemic, but well into the future. And Deputy Mayor Tincher is going to take us through the next couple of slides. Thank you.
Thanks, everyone. Glad to be here. Are you all able to see our slides?
We're not seeing a shared screen right now, or I'm not. Before the committee started, when you did the little test, I could see it. There we go.
Here we go.
Oh, Tommy's got it. Cool. Great. Okay. Welcome to the committee, Deputy Mayor. Please introduce yourself for the record and proceed.
Absolutely. Deputy Mayor Jamie Tincher, City of St. Paul. Tommy, we could go ahead and go to slide 2. And let me just get set up. Sorry. Okay. The following 2 slides provide views of where encampments have been located in St. Paul. Slide 2 is citywide, and then if we go ahead and go to slide 3, that's a focus on downtown. The green dots are locations that are no longer there. The gray dots are abandoned and we're scheduling cleanup. The red dots are locations where individuals are currently staying, and we are working to connect them to indoor options. If you go to slide 4, we just removed the green dots so that you could better see our current situation. As of today, there are 39 people sheltering outdoors in the city of St. Paul. On this slide, slide 4, since 2018, the city of St. Paul has collected this information on encampment locations in order to monitor the health and safety of occupants and to ensure that we are doing everything we can to connect them to services. Prior to COVID, our process was when an encampment location was reported to the city, our staff would go to that location and conduct an initial wellness check. We would track the GS location of the encampment, as well as information that did not specifically identify individual occupants. Then at weekly meetings, city staff, county staff, outreach, and other partners would collectively review each site together to work to ensure that occupants were being connected to caseworkers for housing and other resources or services. Prior to COVID, we also closed encampments. On a site-by-site basis, the city would assess risk factors such as dangers posed by a physical location, including weather conditions, environmental and health hazards, reports of violence and criminal behavior, size and duration, including buildup of trash and waste. Prior to any closing of a site, the city would provide notice to the occupants and outreach workers in order to minimize loss of any property or personal documents. And we would also offer Ramsey County congregate shelter space to occupants. On slide 5, you can see that the COVID-19 pandemic caused an unprecedented rise in the numbers of homeless encampments and unsheltered individuals in the city of St. Paul. As you all know, there are a few different definitions of homelessness that are used for various public policy purposes, but for St. Paul and the data that we're tracking, when we refer to unsheltered homeless individuals, it's the people in our city that we know are sheltering in tents, under bridges, in the woods, in caves, or other places not intended as shelter. If this graph extended back through 2019, you would see a steady line at less than 30 individuals sheltering outdoors in any given week. Our highest weekly counts through our monitoring process in October of that year, 2019, was 19 occupied sites and 26 individuals sheltering outdoors. You can see that when COVID hit in early 2020, our numbers began increasing. At the end of March 2020, we had 20 occupied sites and 42 people sheltering outdoors. By the end of April, there were 68 occupied sites and we went above 100 people sheltering outdoors. In mid-June, the numbers rose above 200 people sheltering outdoors. And in late July, the counts went above 300. We reached a high of 380 people sheltering outdoors before we began turning the curve. We can go to slide 6. That was what was happening outdoors. This flow chart helps show what was happening indoors with programming and services. COVID was basically a perfect storm of conditions that resulted in dramatic increases of people sheltering outdoors. Many people who had previously transitioned in and out of shelter by doubling up or staying periodically with friends or family could no longer find those options due to the need to isolate. Shelters immediately had to reduce their capacity by 50% in order to implement COVID social distancing safety measures. Options for anyone already struggling on the margins dramatically decreased, so anyone financially impacted by COVID and thereby pushed into homelessness also had incredibly limited options. This chart shows the programming and services available to our residents experiencing homelessness. In gray, the 24/7 shelter spaces. In red, the emergency overnight shelter space. In yellow, the space services. And in green, the space for COVID response, isolation, quarantine, and respite. The pre-COVID box shows the capacity we had prior to the pandemic, back when we were seeing less than 30 individuals sheltering outdoors in any given week. Now remember though, that was there was that large number of individuals who were doubling up because they were periodically able to stay with friends and family. When COVID hit, we lost 24/7 space due to health and safety protocols. So Ramsey County added their hotel program. But again, that was just continuing to have the prior capacity, not increased to meet the additional need. The county also had to add space for individuals experiencing homelessness to go to isolate, quarantine, and have respite if they tested positive for COVID. We lost all day space service options as well as public places. So we moved into action planning mode, not only to add more space and staff for services and programming, but simultaneously reassessing our options to address barriers that discouraged individuals from going into shelter. Hearing directly from our residents experiencing homelessness, we knew that we needed to provide more individual rooms. We heard the privacy requests and the safety concerns related to COVID. We knew that storage of belongings and transportation were issues, and we understood that people wanted to stay with their partners and their pets. We also knew that we needed to add more day space options for people experiencing homelessness, a place they could go to get support, take a shower, sleep during the day, do laundry, or just talk to someone and get a cup of coffee. We particularly needed this type of space because of COVID impacts that caused the closure of so much indoor public space, such as our public libraries. And the next few slides are the results we achieved towards those goals in just 4 months. We can go to slide 7.
Yep, thanks, Jamie. I wanted to touch base on some of the sites that we stood up in that short period of time. Bethesda got a lot of press, so you're probably aware of that, very close to the Capitol, but we were able to stand up 70 private rooms there, 24/7, as the previous slide showed, access to meals. We're actually providing mental health support services there and chemical dependency services. One of the things that kind of played out in the press was some of the difficulties around standing these shelters up is the NIMBYism, right? The not my backyard folks that, you know, yeah, we get it, but we don't want it here. This isn't the right spot. And so as we're trying to stand this up, we're also trying to deal with community, build the trust and the relationship with community that we can manage these, that they're needed, and they're actually going to add to the community. And before we stood up Bethesda, that park there was one of the unsheltered camps that really brought a lot of disruption to the community. And since we've stood that up and we've worked with the community, we've worked with folks, it's actually worked out better. We can move on to the next slide. Mary Hall. Mary Hall used to be run by Catholic Charities before the Opportunity Center and Higher Ground. Once they opened up their new facility, they had deactivated that. We had to reactivate that. Ramsey County did. That is our kind of first spot now. It's a respite center, but it's also a first response spot. So folks might stay there a day or two, but then they might move on to Bethesda or one of the other buildings or sites that I'll share with you here. So that is really kind of the entry point for referrals to ensure that we're getting folks to the right spot, the right services, to help support them on a path to stabilization. Next slide, please. Luther Hall Seminary, Stub Hall, 50 private rooms. This is for women and couples. It's also for the gay and lesbian community. And one of the things that we've done, and we've, again, in the short window with a lot, is we've gotten very specific. One of the issues around folks not wanting to come in is we did not offer the right services. We didn't have places where gay and lesbians felt comfortable. We didn't have spots where couples could go. We didn't have spots that, you know, if they had a pet, how could we keep them connected to that pet? And so we had to be responsive to ensure that as we're trying to get people off the street, out of these tents, out of our community and into safe facilities, that we were meeting their needs so that that there wasn't this resistance to being moving into shelter. And a lot of times that resistance came because we did not offer the right services or the right venue or the right the rules that went along with that. So this is a site that couples was always a big thing. They just had nowhere to go, and now we've got a spot for couples. Next slide, please. Jamie's going to talk about the temporary shelter here, but before I do that, there's another site that we don't have a slide for. That's Provincial House in Highland Park, which is, it should be opening very shortly. That's also going to serve potentially up to 20 families with children experiencing homelessness. Pre-COVID, our families, families with children always were taken care of. That was always the highest priority. Probably the one gap left that maybe we can talk a little bit about is the unaccompanied youth. That 16 to 24-year group is probably the one group where we're still struggling to make sure that we find the right spots for them. Jamie, you want to take this slide here and talk a little bit about Harriet Island at Lewton Case?
Sure. Thank you, Jim. We are so grateful for the partnership with the state that provided funding so that the City of St. Paul could make two city buildings available as emergency shelters for our residents experiencing homelessness. They were operated by Ramsey County staff and opened through December 31st, 2020. These congregate settings were never intended to be long-term investments. What we've been doing is really focusing on those individual rooms and meeting those barriers that we've been hearing. But these spaces were necessary temporary spaces to be available as options to get in from the cold until Bethesda and the other operations that Jim just went through were up and running. And we could go to slide 11.
And I'll slide 11 is touches base on our referral process here. And that is, again, I was just calling out the strength of partnerships, right? The encampments, the folks that are unsheltered out on the street, city staff are engaging with them at all levels, whether it's through their department of licensing, through the police force, through the fire department. We've got outreach workers that, we've got two outreach workers that St. Paul Foundations has helped fund for us to be able to make those connections. But making those referrals and getting them screened, and I talked a little bit about how we use Mary Hall as kind of that first spot. Can we get them into Bethesda? Can we get them to Mary Hall or to Luther? Where's that next spot that we want to make sure we get them to? We provide transportation for that. The hotel program, we're still running a hotel program. We can move people into the hotel program, but again, that's kind of a step up. We want to make sure that they're stable enough that they can manage in a hotel program environment. And it doesn't, there's a lot of trauma and stress on these individuals when they come to us. And we've got to recognize that. We've got to make sure that we're providing the support. And just putting somebody in a hotel room is not always the best thing for them. We got to make sure that we're providing them with the support so they feel safe, that we're not compounding that trauma that they've experienced either out on the street or that they've experienced in their life as maybe one of the triggers that caused this homelessness. So throughout this referral process that Ramsey County is managing, we are really working on an individual program and trying to manage individuals so that they don't end up back out on the street, so that we don't have another encampment that Jamie and her licensing folks and her police folks and her fire department folks have to, this revolving door, this circle. So The strength of this referral program is really to bring that stabilization in the step up here in the services that we offer. And we do that, you know, every single day. We're doing that every single day. If you want to move to the next slide, please, I could talk a little bit here about the safe and stable shelter operations. All the operations in Ramsey County Shelter Program have on-site staff 24/7. The staff reflect the residents and have a diverse experience. They work to build relationships with residents and are CPR and Narcan trained. Wraparound services are provided in all programs, 3 meals per day, on-site mental health services, transportation services, healthcare, and nursing. The goal is to provide pathways to housing stability with on-site benefit and housing navigation provided, as well as support to removing barriers to housing. Trauma-informed security. And I can't reemphasize that. The interactions so many of these folks have had, especially with folks with uniforms, has not always been positive, right? And again, we do not want to trigger actions or reactions that are going to compound or make things more difficult. So we really work on informing our security folks on trauma and how to de-escalate and making sure we're provided at 24/7 at all locations. All shelter operations are following the CDC and Minnesota Department of Health guidance to protect clients and staff from COVID. Shelters also have in place COVID testing protocols, and shelter staff provide services and referrals when respite care is needed. And we provide that respite care where folks that either are showing symptoms or have tested positive, we can provide a shelter place for them also. So the next slide we're going to move on to talks a little bit about Freedom House, and Jamie's going to talk about that.
Freedom House in downtown St. Paul, operated by Listening House, is now open every day, 8 a.m. to 8 p.m. It is the former fire station on West 7th, and it was an ideal location for that needed day space services for people experiencing homelessness. It has a full kitchen, showers, laundry services, and semi-private former firefighter sleeping quarters for people to get sleep during the day. This is particularly a need for our residents experiencing homelessness who have night shift work. If we go to slide 14, next steps. On this slide, we have included two graphics. One, the housing continuum from the Minnesota Housing Partnership, and the other, a depiction of the homeless service system flow from Heading Home Ramsey, our continuum of care. And we think these two graphics help provide a focus to any of our policy conversations about what we need to do to better serve our residents experiencing homelessness. Prior to COVID, Mayor Carter and our city council, along with our partners in Ramsey County and St. Paul Public Schools, we're responding to the housing crisis with a variety of strategies from across the spectrum of needs. A couple years ago, the city really started leaning in and coordinating across our departments and deepening our partnerships with the county and service providers to support the work of helping connect residents sheltering outdoors to resources. And this year, the city's approach has evolved even further from tracking numbers of people and locations of encampments to knowing their names, their stories, and their struggles. This level of engagement is going to be incredibly important as our whole community continues to grapple with how we can best prioritize investments and resources. And this helps us actually know how many people need what type of housing and what type of strategies are required to effectively and responsibly meet each person where they are at that moment.
Personally, we believe that good data and analysis coupled with a deep understanding of the human dynamics of a situation is what it leads to real solutions. So for context, some of the data behind our challenge is that we believe there is a gap and a need for more than 15,000 housing units for people at or below 30% area median income in Ramsey County. That's 31,000 a year for a family of four. And the way the market's going now, that grows every single day. We're losing more and more affordable housing in the community. We have had 3,460 permanent supportive housing units with a waiting list of a little bit more than 3,000 folks. Only 2% of those on the coordinated entry priority list found housing in 2019. So moving forward, We do not need an encampment strategy. I think we've demonstrated that we can respond to a crisis with the partners we have, including the state. We're so grateful for that partnership. But we've got to move from quickly responding to crises to a long-term housing strategy so that we can actually bring that stability to folks so they can actually move from surviving to thriving in our community. Last week, I was elected chair, and Deputy Mayor Tincher was elected vice chair of the Ramsey County Heading Home Continuum of our Care. The team's ongoing response and active engagement with our residents experiencing homelessness has helped us better understand so many of the individual situations, support and advance individual solutions, and identify the gaps that exist for some of the most vulnerable people we need to find options for. We have a lot of work to do, but we can do better, and we will. And my last comment, and I've been to a number of those encampments, and I've just been impressed with the deputy mayor. I think she could name, she knows where every single person is right now that's unsheltered in a tent somewhere, but she can name them. And we need that personal connection for us to be able to build that trust to make sure that we can help these folks. So with that, we're going to end. Any questions? But really the challenge here, moving forward, the really big challenge is that stability in permanent housing, especially at that 30% AMI. You know, a lot of conversation around the eviction moratorium crisis. We know that's a cliff that's potentially going to drive more people out into the street. And the emergency assistance grants, and Ramsey County used a lot of our CARES funding to help support folks so that they did not lose their housing because they couldn't pay their heating bill or their rent. But that's ongoing. It will continue to be an ongoing issue that we'll continue to look to the state for partnership with.
Thank you so much, Commissioner and Deputy Mayor, for that presentation. That was actually really helpful for me to see laid out like that. Commissioner, I'm glad that you mentioned sort of at the end of your comments, the kind of like what the deputy mayor has been doing, frankly, and what the administration of the city of St. Paul has decided to do. When we heard from the VA, my time is all messed up, last week, the week before, 2 weeks ago, I think, right? And they too spoke to this list, right, that somebody owns this list of these human beings and how important that is. I guess it's more just a comment, but also kind of, I wonder if you could comment a little bit, Deputy Mayor. You know, the city of St. Paul really has, in kind of tasking you as, you know, somebody who's really high up in the administration with this work, and not just like tasking you with this work, but really asking you to step in the way that you have stepped in and creating space for you to do that. It feels, something about it feels different than the response that I've seen elsewhere, I guess. And so I'm interested in like, do you spend all of your time doing this? How have you guys redeployed staff within the city? How are you doing this, I guess, is part of my question, because, you know, that sort of really focused attention seems really critical. And so I guess I just wonder if you could speak to that a little bit.
Sure. And what I will say is we have council members. Commissioner McDonough goes to the encampments and talks with and meets with people. Commissioner Mattis Castillo has been out with me many times. Our senior leadership at the city, so our emergency management director, he and I spent a lot of time meeting folks that were in encampments and figuring out, you know, what are your needs? Do you have a caseworker? Who are you working with? And so it has been at all levels of leadership, getting to that ground level and really understanding what is going on with folks and what do we need to do? How do we champion systems that are going to work for folks? And, you know, we have amazing outreach partners. We have our partners, our police department, our fire department has been out, you know, pulling everybody together and helping everybody refocus our work on that human-centered piece. You know, who are the human beings that all of us just need to come around and figure out we have all these resources and, you know, it was 380 people and then we needed it to be 370 people and then it needed to be 360 people. And we just had to start figuring out one by one by one, what does that person need right now? Who can have that trust with that person, get them to take that leap with us and go inside and get the services and the resources that are going to help them, as Commissioner McDonough said, thrive. And it's very individual for each person. And what we needed to do was figure out, what does that person need? Who's the right person to connect them to that? And then how do we help track them through that process and keep following up on that? So myself, but many others in leadership positions in St. Paul and Ramsey County, we've taken that approach and it's been really important and critical for the success that we want to have for the folks that we care about.
Thank you so much, Deputy. Sure. Oh, yeah, Commissioner, yes.
If I could just briefly touch on standing these up and redeploying, because it not only took financial resources, right, it took human capital to staff these and manage these. And at the same time, in Ramsey County, we were standing up a housing stability office to help manage this. But, you know, we had parks and rec workers that no longer, our ice arenas weren't open, our beaches weren't open, but they moved into helping us and staffing these. St. Paul brought parks and rec workers and other staff that redeployed, and they did it to help staff the hotels and move this forward. And then I want to take a moment and recognize a lot of community partners stepped up too in helping us here, whether it was actually staffing or providing support services as we move forward. So it was big, it was complex, but people really put their best foot forward here to make this work.
Thank you so much, Commissioner McDonough. We had a couple of member questions. I wanted to go to Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you both so much for the presentation. This was really interesting, and it's especially interesting to see we've kind of experienced in this committee that there's a lot of disorder in this space. There's a lot happening, but it's many times it's very disconnected. And it's really interesting to see how you have managed to work with this homeless population in such a structured way and a personal way at the same time. It's really impressive. So thank you for the presentation. My question is, and Commissioner McDonough, I think that you had mentioned that one of the challenges you still have, one of the problems that you have not solved, is the unaccompanied youth. And we've had conversations about this population in the past in the committee. And I'm wondering, what are you finding sort of the unique challenges to be with that population? And I suppose we need to know the challenges so we can figure out how to get past them, right?
Yeah, I'll briefly just touch base. Yep. Briefly, thank you, Chair Gomez, and thank you for the question. You know, a couple of things, and certainly I'll look to Jamie to weigh in, but this group is the group that's, I want to be respectful here, but the group that's probably not seen, unseen the most, right? They're the most hidden in our community. And in some ways, COVID really affected them. Even Jamie talked about couch hopping. This group was couch hoppers for the most part. They certainly were on the streets, but once COVID hit, that opportunity to stay with friends, with family, to couch hop disappeared because of COVID, and it got really tough. And so more of them ended up out on the street. This group also is the group that everybody on the street is vulnerable for some type of exploitation, you know, whether it's sexual or physical or some type of, but this group is also vulnerable probably to the most exploitation. And so, it's a difficult group to build trust with. It's a difficult group to make connections with. They find a buddy and they want to stay together. Even getting them into a hotel room, which you think, you know, our perspective, our life experience would say, yes, I want a bed, I want to be warm. But for them, it was, no, I want to be with my buddy, so, one person that I trust in this whole world. I cannot leave that person, because every time I have, I've been exploited, I've been harmed. And so that group is extremely tough to make those connections. Jamie, I don't know if you got anything else to add to that.
Thank you.
You got it.
Okay. Thank you so much, Commissioner. Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And thank you, Commissioner McDonough and Jamie, sorry, Deputy Mayor. I'm really appreciative of all the work that you're doing. I'm so proud to be in the city of St. Paul and in Ramsey County, where you all have been doing fantastic work. And I know really proactively attempting to address this issue. And it was great to see updated statistics, because I think I saw them probably back in November. So this is really interesting. And I appreciate all the work that you've done. My question is really, as I'm learning more about homelessness and what we can do, I want to know what things did you folks learn that you didn't know beforehand that maybe we're missing, right, as people who are not experiencing homelessness? And you know, if you were able to address those things, how did you address them? And if you weren't able to, I want to know that too, because that helps us understand how to move forward.
Commissioner or Deputy Mayor, please go ahead.
Well, I'll jump in. I learn stuff every day. I still learn stuff. And a lot of it is, you know, the space is hard, and there are so many good people who come into the space, and they just want to help people. And we have had to struggle to figure out, you know, how do we move through this space? And those struggles have been real. What I will say, though, is because we have so many good people who we find a way to recenter and focus on, we're trying to save lives. We're literally trying to save lives. And so whatever drama is happening, we need to get past it and just move forward and save lives. The gaps, I mean, we figured out a lot of barriers. So when we would hear challenges from folks and they would say, I don't want to go into your shelters. And we would say, why? And Commissioner McDonough mentioned it, you know, they're a couple. They had, you know, transportation, or what about my stuff? This is everything I have in the world. What's going to happen to my stuff? And so, you know, the city of St. Paul, we are storing individual stuff while they go indoors so that they can be warm and get services. So there's ways that we can tackle those barriers if we're listening and trying to tackle them. The gaps that we still have, we have individuals who, despite the changes and the monumental efforts that the county of Ramsey has done to modify their operations, we still have some individuals who they just are not successful in the options that we are providing right now. Some of it is they may have PTSD, that trust issue. There are rules that for the safety of individuals that are staying in those spaces and the staff that are serving them, we just have some folks that they're just not able to follow those rules right now. And they're not able to be in those spaces. But we can't accept that the only option for that individual is to be outside. And so we have some gaps where we have to figure out, what are the right resources? What are the right ways that we can provide that programming? And, you know, Jim and I and the Heading Home Ramsey folks and all of the partners we're working with, we have some gaps and we've got to figure it out. And that'll take resources and willingness, but we're still trying to tackle those. And we would love the state and this committee's help and support in those efforts.
Chair Gomez, if I could add just a little bit to that.
Of course,
thank you. Representative Hollins, one of the things that I've maybe just it's really reinforced and opened my eyes to, Jamie talked about those gaps. We've got to be willing to kind of break away from the status quo on what we think are the right fill-ins, right? There's legislation right now about tiny homes and how do we allow them as a solution. We're working with the veterans on yard homes and what does single occupancy rooms look like. We've got to get more creative and be willing to move to solutions that meet their needs rather than asking them to meet our needs that we've defined in the past. And we've got to be able to move past that and be creative and support and eliminate. We create a lot of the barriers ourselves with our own rulemaking, with our own statutes, with our own zoning. And we've got to figure out how to break down those barriers to provide those solutions for folks.
Thank you so much for that, Commissioner. Representative Hollins?
I just had a quick follow-up. Speaking of different zoning and things like that, I remember the accessory dwellings coming up as a popular, as an important item that we were looking at and whether or not we could get that passed. And I know that it did pass for the city of St. Paul, and yet I hear there's not a lot of people taking advantage of that. I think one or two people, something like that, have actually asked for the permits to do that. And so as we're looking towards the future, do you think options like that are something that we could do to improve housing for folks who are unsheltered, or is that just too unlikely?
Commissioner, Deputy Mayor?
I'm optimistic. I think that there's a lot of support for it. And I frankly think that those options, while I think that they would help in our unsheltered space, I think there are members of our community that would very much want to see those options, whether they have experienced homelessness or not. I think that those are important solutions along the housing continuum.
Yep.
Thank you so much. Representative Petersburg.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I think Representative New Brindley and as well as the commissioner really, I think, said a lot of good things. I also am very impressed with the process that the city of St. Paul had, and others that we're hearing now actually worked at first trying to determine what the issues are and what the problems are, not by what they anticipated or perceived it to be, but actually going out and talking with the individuals, finding what their needs are, understanding that because we're all unique, we all come from different backgrounds and different rationale and reasons why we're at where we're at, means that one size doesn't fit all. And it sounds like this particular program is trying to address the various needs that are out there. And it's really something that I think we need to be working on, even if it's a task force over the summer, to figure out how we can implement the same style, not the same exact thing, but the same style that is kind of an example for the rest of the state to be able to use in conjunction with knowledge and experience from the peers that we're hearing from what's going on with the commissioner and the deputy mayor. It really is something that it's important for us to know that up till this point, people saw the homelessness issue as too big an issue for any one entity to take on. So they dealt with one little piece of it. Well, that one little piece of it didn't match with the rest. And so become much more disjointed over the process of developing all these programs. All of them may be good programs, but they aren't dealing with it as a whole. And we have basically sometimes winners and losers because of that. Whereas it seems like this approach that has been done was really entirely dependent upon looking at holistically as to what we can do all the way across the board, which sounds monumental, but it was just shown now that it was possible. So thank you for your work. Thank you for your guidance. And I hope we can utilize what we are learning here today into the future. So thank you for your presentation.
Thank you so much, Representative Petersburg, and thanks again to the Commissioner and Deputy Mayor for joining us today. Deputy Mayor, when I was sort of like opened our committee, I referred back to the conversation that you and I had a while back because, you know, I think that all of us in this committee have kind of like, we've been struggling together to get our arms around this issue, just kind of writ large, and also the like sort of many layered public response to it. and it feels really overwhelming sometimes. And, you know, it made me feel better to hear from you, like, as somebody who has worked in public policy for so many years, to be like, this is like one of the hardest and most complicated issues that exists in public policy. And so I've kind of carried that with me to kind of be like, when I start freaking out about like, oh my God, I just like don't have it together yet here, that your words provide me some comfort. And I think our committee, right, as we're working to really like dig in here. So you provided a really great, important part of the puzzle to us today. So thank you so much for being here. And we'll be in touch. And you know, as Representative Petersburg said, we have work to do outside of our normal committee schedule. And we're going to be calling on you to help the work that you've done kind of inform ours going forward. So thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next, we're going to hear from St. Louis County Commissioner Laura Birnbaum. Commissioner Birnbaum previously joined us to share some of the challenges facing homeless youth in St. Louis County. And today, she's going to give us some perspective on the current challenges and successes serving the unsheltered populations in her region. So welcome back to the committee, Commissioner Birnbaum.
Thank you, Madam Chair and committee members. So as you know, my name is Laura Birnbaum, and actually I'm not a county commissioner. I am simply, that's okay for the record, simply a St. Louis County Public Health and Human Services supervisor. So I work with our housing and homelessness programs across the county. And again, I'm pleased and grateful to be with you again this morning. So thank you. As you mentioned, Madam Chair, 2 weeks ago, I had the opportunity to join you. And last time I spoke to this committee, it was about youth homelessness. So today I'd like to zoom out and share a little bit more about our community, people experiencing homelessness in our community, the impact of COVID-19 and our responses thus far. This past summer, we saw an unprecedented number of people sleeping outside. More tents were distributed than ever before. Now our warming center continues to reach capacity within an hour of opening its doors. 2 weeks ago, I shared data around the number of families, youth, including youth parents who are experiencing or at risk of homelessness. And today I wanted to share that out of the 1,240 households that are currently on our priority list in Southern St. Louis County alone, of the 1,240, 860 people are singles, and over half of those individuals qualify for our long-term homelessness housing support program, but may wait yet over a year for housing. If a person qualifies for this program, it means they've experienced homelessness for over a year or four times in the past 3 years. It also means that they meet certain income and asset limits, as well as have a disability that limits their self-sufficiency. For example, they may have disabilities related to mental or chemical health, and therefore would need or benefit from supplemental services, things like medication reminders, help with transportation, making appointments, and connecting to other social services. Without these additional supports and service connections in place, people often risk losing their housing. And COVID-19 has really shown a light on this. We've seen households who have lost the necessary level of support from case management to mental health providers due to the pandemic, who then have had increased mental health symptoms and or substance use. This often leads to an inability to follow through on important paperwork related to housing, insurance, or SNAP renewals, all of which can spiral and lead to even more mental, physical, and chemical health concerns, as well as eviction and homelessness. COVID-19 has not only impacted people with supportive housing in place already, but clearly people who were and are now currently experiencing homelessness. As noted, with permanent supportive housing, it works when people have access to services and supports to not only maintain their housing, but to support their recovery process, whatever that may be or may look like. This could be access to peer recovery specialists, treatment, a therapist, psychiatry, primary care, or home health care. We have worked really hard in our COVID-19 response to have a more holistic approach that recognizes the intersectionality of physical, mental, and chemical health with housing. Like many counties, we set up isolation and quarantine sites with our shelter partners, CHUM in Duluth and AEOA in Northern St. Louis County, for people who are experiencing homelessness who've either tested positive for COVID-19, who are awaiting test results, or have had close contact with somebody who've tested positive. We've ensured that meals are provided, as well as mental health and substance use disorder supports via telehealth are available. And we used home health care in settings also when needed. The work has relied on the tremendous collaboration within St. Louis County, hotels, public health, hospitals, shelters, and other service providers. We've used CARES dollars as well as ESP and OEO funds to support our isolation and quarantine sites. We were committed to the work as soon as we knew the need was coming and had been entering into contracts before we were aware of the CARES funds, which have been greatly helpful and have partnered with DHS moving forward as well. But even with these funding sources, we still have uncertainty on how we'll cover all of the costs. We've also worked with the City of Duluth and Chum to lease different hotel rooms for people experiencing homelessness who are over the age of 65 and or have underlying conditions that put them at higher risk for COVID. This shelter expansion effort has been tremendously successful and is a model for an additional expansion that we are currently working on with Chum and other partners that could provide additional supportive housing post-COVID, helping address this huge need we have in our community. We have community service providers coming to our warming center weekly, including community health workers from Lake Superior Community Health Center and mental health case managers from St. Louis County. Hotel vouchers are being utilized in Northern St. Louis County, so households have a warm place to go when the shelter is full. In Northern St. Louis County, we've also pulled together stakeholders, including housing providers and case managers, mental health providers, and substance use treatment providers together to identify gaps and work on addressing the expanding needs that COVID has presented for the communities we serve. In Duluth, we meet monthly with a homelessness and healthcare team that includes healthcare providers, clinics and hospitals, Lutheran Social Services, the Loaves and Fishes community, our medical respite home, and CHUM to ensure we're working together to meet the intersecting needs pre, during, and post-COVID. Across our county, we also have designated public health liaisons for specific populations and settings. I've had the privilege of working closely with the liaisons who are supporting our shelters, board and lodges, and supportive housing providers. These relationships have been instrumental in our approach, support and response to COVID, including accessing PPE, testing, and vaccination rollout. We have prioritized populations experiencing homelessness and housing instability and staff in our vaccination implementation. We also know that people of African heritage, Black, Indigenous, people of color, and the LGBTQIA2S community are not only disproportionately impacted by homelessness, but also COVID. Our vaccination efforts have also prioritized these communities. Lastly, we have intentionally created and included our housing and homelessness partners and providers in funding opportunities to support their work during COVID and hopefully beyond COVID with some of the COVID relief funds, such as CARES dollars. We don't know yet what the lasting impact of the pandemic may be in our communities, not just economic, but also on our collective mental health and well-being. School social workers are working with families in transition experiencing homelessness and have expressed their concern around the need for increased support once students are back in school, again, knowing that these needs will be magnified. So we've done a lot of work and we have learned a lot of lessons and we know we have much more to do. COVID-19 did not change the need for households experiencing homelessness or housing instability. It only amplified and exposed the issues that have been underlying for a long time. I'm hopeful that with the unique opportunities that this pandemic has provided, the silver lining, so to say, such as increased partnerships, the deepened understanding of people who are experiencing homelessness by other disciplines, the increased resources and the rule flexibilities or waivers can continue post-COVID as the need continues to grow. This concludes my remarks. I really would like to thank you all for your time and willingness to listen to St. Louis County's story. In a perfect world, we would love shelter infrastructure support, program flexibility, and the long-term commitment to program funding for youth homelessness services, as well as housing navigation services to better support our coordinated entry system. I know these are major asks, and the legislature has many things it's considering this year, but know that we are ready and willing to help wherever we can. And I'll stay on for any questions that you may have. Thanks again so much for the opportunity.
So much for joining us, Ms. Birnbaum. We really appreciate you giving us that kind of higher overview. So I'm not seeing any member questions. So I think we're going to move on to our next presentation. And if you wouldn't mind, if you're able to stick around, you know, at the end of our conversation, we might have something you'd want to jump in on. So thank you so much for that. Appreciate you. Next, we're going to hear from Hennepin County. They'll be sharing their current work on housing affordability, homelessness, and the challenges they've faced with COVID-19. With us, we have Julia Well-Ayers and David Hewitt. If either of you would like to introduce yourselves and proceed with your testimony, that would be great.
Good morning, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for having us this morning. I am Julia Welly Ayers. I'm with Hennepin County with the Housing and Economic Development Department. And as you said, I'm joined by David Hewitt, the director of Hennepin County's Housing Stability Department. As you noted, we're just going to walk you briefly through Hennepin County's housing landscape, what we're seeing, our housing activities, and then also what we've learned through COVID-19. Again, thank you for your time. I'm going to share a slide. That working for you, Madam Chair? Wonderful. Almost one third of Hennepin County households are housing cost burdened. This means they spend more than 30% of their income on housing costs. Of this group, we're particularly concerned about the 41,000 households with extremely low incomes, meaning incomes below 30% of the area median income, who are severely housing cost burdened, paying more than one half of their income toward housing costs every month. This group is most likely to become homeless without support, as they have so little money left over to afford other basic needs like food, transportation, education, and medical care after paying rent. While many factors contribute to housing affordability challenges, we know that housing costs are increasing while incomes are decreasing. Over the last 20 years, median rents in Hennepin County have increased 10%, while median renter income decreased 5%. So here's what Hennepin County has been doing. The county programs were up to $146 million each year to support homeless and housing activities. That's outside of CARES funding. And that includes critical support from the state. Our capital investment programs have created or preserved 7,500 units of affordable housing since 2010, currently averaging around 1,100 units every year due to increased investments. By funding housing location services, case management, rent assistance, and supportive housing operations, we can help more than 23,000 households access and maintain stable housing every year. And 8,000 people experiencing homelessness utilize our shelters supported by the county every year. This is only a small sample of our annual housing outcomes, but again, it represents the large impact of our current activities, again, with the support of state funding. Here I'll pass to Mr. Hewitt to continue.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of committee. So my name is David Hewitt, Director of Housing Stability for Hennepin County Human Services, and I'll briefly speak to the context of the homelessness work and some of our work in the pandemic. First, building on Ms. Warrier's points, everyone, or literally 9.5 out of every 10 people we see on the streets or in shelter, is earning 30% area median income or less, and often far less. It should be noted that more than 20% of the individuals we see in shelter are working, but are still in this income bracket and are still trapped in homelessness by the low and often erratic nature of that income. I heard our colleagues in St. Paul and Ramsey County earlier reference their gap in terms of the number of households in this income bracket and the number of housing units available. For completeness and reference, our gap is 60,000 units, 74,000 households, but only 14,000 units that are affordable to them in this 30% area median income and below. So extreme poverty is a necessary condition for an individual or household to find themselves on the street or in shelter with nowhere else to go, but it is not a sufficient condition because not everyone in this income bracket literally becomes homeless. They may well be going without meeting other basic needs and experiencing housing instability, but when we look at homelessness and the at-risk factors there, what we see and what this slide represents is that people of color experience homelessness at far higher rates than poverty alone can explain. And two primary drivers of this racial disparity are the racial disparity pile up, where disparities in multiple systems across health, justice, employment, multiply the number of barriers to housing that people of color face. What we also see, the second I would describe as a network impoverishment, if you will, where homelessness could have been avoided, but for lack of resources at the community as well as the individual level. So our responses have to directly address these challenges. If we go to the next slide. The numbers you see here are rounded, but reflective of our annual point in time count. In four of the last 5 point in time counts, the number of individuals identified as homeless in Hennepin County has been between 3,000 and 3,100. This includes people who are unsheltered and those in shelter and transitional housing projects, grouped together as shelter here. That's the HUB definition. An important point to note here is that in 2020, the total number of people who exited homelessness, who left homelessness to a permanent destination across all of our programs, was 2,165. So almost six people a day, every single day of 2020 for 365 days straight, ended their homelessness and moved into a permanent home. And further, thousands more people stay in a shelter or in an unsheltered situation, leave that situation without a known destination and do not return. So we have this huge exit piece that we don't know about as well. And yet numbers often remain the same or even increase. And that's why we focus on these two arrows here, the entries to homelessness and the exits from homelessness, because these are the forces that dictate how many residents at any given time are homeless. They dictate the size of the shelter need. They dictate the scale of encampment crises, and making progress on reducing homelessness and indeed ending homelessness is entirely contingent on reducing the numbers becoming homeless and increasing the numbers that exit. We can go to the next slide here. So turning to the last year, in which a lot of work has been crammed in, and the pandemic. So prior to the declaration of the state of emergency, we had identified three principal risks: that congregate settings and an inability to socially distance would lead to mass outbreaks among people experiencing homelessness, that the higher incidence of medical fragility in this population, particularly the growing number of seniors, would result in severe medical complications from COVID. And third, really, that the homeless response system that serves thousands of people each day would not be able to continue doing so. And so these guided three core strategies. First, the establishment of isolation space where people who were COVID positive or presumptive could, whether they were unsheltered or in shelter, could be relocated to safely recuperate while reducing the transmission risk to others. And that measure has enabled us to prevent individual cases from becoming clusters or quickly controlling any clusters that do emerge. And about just under 700 people have benefited from those sites so far. For reference, just about half of them tested positive. The second strategy was establishing non-congregate shelter using repurposed hotels for those who were senior or otherwise at high risk. And more than 1,100 have been sheltered in those settings so far. Our third strategy was to bolster the existing homeless response system as a first point to keep it functioning. So as we established the non-congregate shelters, we were also able to deconcentrate the existing congregate shelters by more than half while maintaining and actually increasing capacity. Still, seeing the growth in unsheltered homelessness in our community, we worked with the City of Minneapolis to add outreach teams through our nonprofit partners, including culturally specific outreach services, going back to that kind of disparity piece and the need to have a response to that. And also through the Hennepin County Healthcare for the Homeless services. And those services were really at the forefront of meeting people where they were at and developing those individualized solutions to people's homelessness that are so critical, which we discussed earlier, in order to help bring people inside wherever possible. We worked to add new shelter programs that were specifically designed around the needs that were seen on the streets and in encampments. So $5.7 million was allocated from Hennepin's CARES Act allocation for the acquisition and capital costs of two new shelters. The American Indian Community Development Corporation's Homeward Bound shelter, offering those culturally specific services, and then the Avivo Villages shelter, really designed in community with community around the needs of people who are unsheltered. And in addition, we added a small scale women's shelter, which had been a long-term need through Salvation Army to add individual rooms and care for some of those women who weren't who were opting out of shelter options when they were co-located with men's spaces. Through those measures, we added 180 beds targeted specifically to the needs of people who go unsheltered, not through lack of capacity, although capacity doesn't remain a challenge, but rather because of those additional needs that were spoken about earlier that existing shelters have not historically met. Mm-hmm. Pets, partners, privacy, possessions, the need for chemical health services and culturally specific services. We also allocated 3.2 million from CARES to make physical modifications to the existing shelters that add airflow systems, restrooms, showers, laundry, storage, partitions, and allocated a further $2.5 million to ensure that they could continue operating 24/7. So as a result of all of those measures, we are today sheltering about 1,100 single adults in a 24/7 system that is the largest and most intensive shelter system our community has ever seen. And critically, I think when we are on the other side of this pandemic, what that represents, what we will have is a shelter system that can better meet the health and housing needs of people experiencing homelessness, particularly those who have historically opted out of that system. But still, shelter is not the answer, housing is. And so for those who still opt out of shelter, outreach teams will continue working towards housing directly. And I would just call back that kind of 2,165 people who moved into permanent housing last year from either sheltered or unsheltered settings. With that, I can hand back to Ms. Welly-Ayres.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt, Madam Chair, members of the committee. So again, our goal in 2020 was to do what we've always tried to do, which was minimize the number of people coming into homelessness, maximize the number that are leaving homelessness. One of the big things we did, like many others across the state of Minnesota and the country, was to create a new emergency rental assistance program. So Hennepin allocated $16.2 million of its coronavirus relief fund toward emergency rent assistance. In Hennepin County, this program assisted more than 6,000 low-income households. Two-thirds of those households had extremely low incomes, and half of them lived in zip codes most heavily affected by the economic impacts of COVID-19. That's the map you can see here. The blue dots are the concentrations of households receiving assistance. These households we assisted, we identified with data to be the ones who did not have income to pay rent and would have been homeless without the dual support of rent assistance and the eviction moratorium. In addition, this assistance helped property owners to pay their bills and to make necessary repairs to their buildings. We also got to administer $6 million of the state's COVID-19 Housing Assistance Program, or CHAP, and we were grateful for that support and collaboration. We learned a lot about delivering crisis emergency rent assistance in 2020, both about how to do it and the benefits of doing it. So some examples, I heard that question earlier, our programs wouldn't have been successful without cross-governmental coordination at a level we'd never seen before, without direct culturally specific outreach and application assistance. We think it was those housing navigators and application assisters that got us to this right concentration of assistance. And of course, lots of new funding. At this point, we do believe that if the eviction moratorium is expired planfully and allowing for the typical 1 month rent assistance processing time, we do think we can avoid massive evictions and housing instability. One final activity we wanted to highlight from 2020, it was our strategic property acquisition. Last fall, we purchased 4 properties across Hennepin County to replace the hotels that Mr. Hewitt mentioned we were leasing for isolation and protective shelter. These acquisitions supported vulnerable residents, they drastically reduced our leasing expenses, and they've now resulted in the county having 4 properties that could be converted to permanent housing after the pandemic. The project shown here, Stevens Square, is already operating as an extremely affordable permanent housing. We believe that it falls into the single room occupancy model of housing. Its tenants are former protective shelter guests and people experiencing chronic homelessness who have enough income to afford modest rents. After purchasing the building, the county leased the building to Alliance Housing, who now operates the project with rents of only $375 a month. This project has attained deep affordability without any tax credits, bonds, or rent subsidies because our initial investment removed any debt or financing concerns. This is going to be a model for us to learn from as we move forward, and we're eager to share those learnings from you and explore what that means for other parts of Minnesota. So Mr. Hewitt and I just outlined what we did and what we learned in the last year, including our shelter system improvements, our emergency rental assistance, and our strategic property acquisition. Together, these activities demonstrated how effectively we can prevent people from becoming homeless and help people exit homelessness with broad collaboration and increased funding. We're really proud of the impacts of this work and grateful for the federal and state support that made it possible. Mr. Hewitt?
Yes, final slide. Thank you, Ms. Wallace. So while this has been an enormously challenging period, some of the lessons from COVID do point us towards a different path for our community from the one that we had coming in, where we were seeing those increases in unsheltered homelessness year on year. One piece that we haven't spoken about as much, and perhaps for reasons that will become apparent, is that we've actually seen new homelessness cases drop at an unbelievable rate among families. There are about 200 fewer children in shelter today compared to this day last year. I was at People Serving People last night. It is almost eerie compared to our experience pre-pandemic in terms of the lower numbers of people in there and the impact that has on the environment and the calmness of the environment. We believe, as Ms. Williams said, that is in large part because of the rental assistance that has been made available and the measures around evictions. And so this is a moment really to think about how we prevent a return to that status quo in which hundreds more children were entering homelessness. If we can keep these reductions as they are, keep these entries lower, we can reduce that, we can stop that happening. And you know, as well as being traumatic right now, childhood homelessness is a predictor of future homelessness. So this is a way we get truly upstream for the years ahead. Going back to some of the points made by the previous speakers around youth homelessness, if we can address it at root, we will be much better positioned moving forwards. When people do enter crisis, we need to view shelter as the emergency room of a housing crisis. If we visit an emergency room that is overflowing with people, they're in the corridors lining up to the door, it's not unreasonable to ask whether more waiting space is needed. But if we speak to those waiting, what they most likely want is to be helped more quickly. The emergency that brings them there is not resolved by providing more waiting space, but rather by having more medical staff and medical interventions available. If you'll excuse me stretching the analogy to breaking point. As an example, we brought a team online to assist with moving folks from our hotel shelters, knowing that that was ultimately unsustainable. We need to get them into permanent housing. When we brought online that team, we doubled the speed at which we were housing people, doubled it. We went from one every 2 days to one every single day. We've now moved more than 180 people out of those sites to permanent housing. And these are seniors and others with medical fragility who've been languishing in shelters and unsheltered settings for years. One example brought to my attention recently was an individual we've been trying to house since the 2018 Hiawatha encampment. They are now living in their own apartment, having come through one of our high-risk sites during the pandemic and then connected onto housing. Another individual to highlight again the impact of the Stephen Square program that Ms. Wallace described. They've moved into that program after several years homeless. And in this case, it was an individual who was previously sleeping in the park opposite the building they now live in. And that's part of their backstory. So we see in this 24/7 operations, deeper case management, the opportunities to create more deeply affordable housing, an opportunity in a historic moment, really, where if we make the right investments to increase exits from homelessness, we can actually set a different path for our community where we're reducing unsheltered homelessness year on year, where we're reducing the need for emergency shelter year on year. With that, we can take any questions, Madam Chair.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt and Ms. Willie Ayers. We're going to go first to Representative New Brindley.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thanks so much for the presentation. I have just a couple of questions. Ms. Willie Ayers, I really appreciated the presentation regarding the Stephen Square residents. I mean, this, it seems like a great solution. It's wonderful. Given that they have their own room, their shared bathrooms, it sounds like they're shared spaces as well. Is there additional staffing then in this building or security in this building? I mean, it's not a traditional apartment setting. So what kind of additional staffing do you have there?
Ms. Willie Ayers.
Madam Chair, Representative, this actually is operating as an independent permanent affordable housing building. So there is an on-site caretaker who can respond to building needs over the weekend or help people access emergency services. And then there's more importantly, person-centered property management, which is a hallmark of Alliance in particular, and some other providers in the county and the state. But the real beauty of this model is there are all these people in shelter. We think more than 20% of people in shelter have enough income to pay these modest rents and don't actually need ongoing services beyond that, or they could engage it on their own through ARMS or Medicaid.
Thank you, Representative Newbrin-Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And two questions with a follow-up. Because it just seems like the shared space could create some additional concerns. So my questions would be, how long has the building been operating? And have you had any additional, particularly security concerns there? Like I said, with those shared spaces, you would think that there could be some additional concerns.
Ms. Welly Ayers.
Madam Chair, Representative, the building opened December 30th. And we just completed filling it at the beginning of March. And thus far, we've had no, as far as I have been informed, we've had no, you know, police needs. We've had no major conflict. And I think that, again, this comes to what happens when people are offered independent, dignified housing. And when there's property, person-centered property management that gives everybody that space they need. So everybody has quite a large room, actually, compared to typical rooming houses and SROs. But the shared spaces haven't been an issue. There are additional COVID protections right now, of course, so it is possible they're using the common rooms less than they will in future years.
Representative Newbrin-Lee.
Thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for that. That's actually great to hear. That's really interesting. My next question is, you mentioned the eviction moratorium and doing that in a thoughtful way, and your belief is that if we can do that in a thoughtful way, we won't see, we'll be able to manage that cliff. And so I would just be curious to know your further thoughts on that, on how you would foresee, I mean, I think everyone understands that at some point that probably is going to have to end. And so I'm wondering what your thoughts are on how the best way to do that for this population to help manage that.
Ms. Willie Ayers.
Madam Chair, Representative, that's a really great question. And there are so many really smart people who I know are speaking with you about their ideas. Speaking specifically from my perspective of working closely with landlords and with our rent assistance program in the last year, it would be wonderful if we could find a way to prevent eviction filings, not only just the charges, because those filings stay on people's records for years and make it really hard for them to find new housing. The way we could do that is slow down the actual filing to give people enough time to apply for emergency rent assistance. And what we are finding over the last couple of years really is it takes up to a month, maybe even more for that piece. So if there was a way to slow it down so that renters had that opportunity, that window to apply for assistance and find out if they're eligible before the eviction could be filed. Beyond that, I think there's a lot of smart people on your committee who would work out additional details.
Thank you very much for that, Ms. Willie Ayers. Those of us who sit on the housing committee know that some of those policy recommendations that you have are making their way through our process, and that we have one of the fastest kind of turnarounds in the country on evictions, and it makes it really difficult for people to have the time, you know, to your point, to apply even for the resources that we do have out there, which of course means that, you know, if they're allowed that little bit of extra time, then the landlord gets paid and the family is stabilized, right? Which is what we're looking for. You know, the other piece that you mentioned is about the ways that even, you know, unlike most kind of crimes or whatever, most like court filings, even if an eviction filing is not sustained, even if the eviction does not go through, that the filing remains on people's records. And of course, in a really tight rental market like we have, that just presents all of these challenges and access. So thank you for bringing those up. Representative Newbrin-Lee, did you have anything further or?
Thank you, Madam Chair. I do have one other question. You know, I mean, it seems like, and hopefully with the vaccine, we are in the near future going to be moving away from the COVID crisis, but of course, there's always new challenges and new things happen. And I'm wondering, we're seeing a significant population entering the country via our southern border again. Are we experiencing any additional population here in Minneapolis or Hennepin County? And maybe the folks from Ramsey County could answer that as well if it's an issue. Are we experiencing any additional burden from that as well? Or maybe not yet, or are you anticipating anything from that?
I don't know if either of you have have anything that you wanted to comment on that, Mr. Hewitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I can certainly say that we have not seen any new impacts in terms of migration into the system at this point and are not anticipating any. Of course, there is always movement that we see when we look at, for instance, in our single adult shelter system, which serves around 5,500 individuals a year. Approximately a third of them have a last permanent address outside of Hennepin County, which is split between folks from the rest of course, the state, and then folks from outstate as well. So we see, and of course, then we know that there are folks who are leaving Hennepin County to go to other services as well. So we know that there is a lot of movement within a segment of this population, which really speaks to the need to regional solutions and statewide solutions. And, you know, wherever possible, we want to be able to support people in their home communities to remain there and to be able to resolve their crisis at point without having to seek services elsewhere. So I would kind of call out that point, but we haven't seen any notable shift that I'm aware of in those numbers.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. Representative New Brindley.
Thanks so much, Madam Chair.
Thank you. Representative Hornstein.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And I also wanted to thank all of the presenters today. I think that you've shown just incredible commitment and just such a holistic, multifaceted way of addressing this issue. And, you know, somewhat along the lines of Representative New Brindley's questions, you know, and I think all of you have shown this relational piece to the work that I think is so important. And Madam Chair, you exemplified that, I think, in your work over the summer and since then with the encampment in Powderhorn and other places in Minneapolis. You had developed these personal relationships with many of the folks there. And so I'm wondering, and maybe this is for Mr. Hewitt, you know, you had talked about the lowered numbers in the family shelter, for example, and it's very difficult to predict what could happen this summer. There's so many variables, you know, the employment, people's employment situations, the economy, how much funding even the state can provide, the state of the pandemic. But do you see, or any of the testifiers, are you able to predict what could potentially happen this summer? You know, because we had the issue with encampments, particularly in Hennepin and Ramsey, but all over, but especially here. Do you have any sense? Do you project these things out? And again, knowing there's many variables and it's hard to predict, do you have any sense of what we might be able to expect this summer?
Mr. Hewitt?
Thank you, Madam Chair, Representative. I'm happy to give a response. I would also perhaps suggest Ms. Williers, I know, has been doing some work around what we expect with this rental assistance eviction piece, so we'll invite kind of additions there. I mean, in terms of projecting out, of course, we are living through unprecedented times, and my crystal ball is a little foggier than usual. What we traditionally see in family homelessness in particular is a seasonal effect, which is interesting in this current context. So traditionally, homelessness starts increasing amongst families around about the time that the school year traditionally ends. Obviously, the school year is a whole new thing now as well. But it is traditionally kind of from April, May through to November that we actually see a doubling of the number of families that come looking for assistance in relation to homelessness and coming into the shelter system. That did not happen last year. We believe, as has been said, in large part because of the measures around evictions and the amounts of rental assistance available. But if we were to assume a return to the status quo this year, and I think with the rental assistance available, we should not make that assumption. But if that were to occur, then we would expect to see the very low numbers we have right now, about 35 families in Hennepin County shelter, for reference, to go up significantly over the next 5 months. With regards to single adults, we traditionally see an increase in the summer, particularly in unsheltered settings, in the range of a couple of hundred. It was obviously much higher than that last year. This one, the crystal ball is definitely foggier on, but as of right now and where we are right now, the additional systems have been put in place, and in particular those additional shelter programs, and I look to a system like Avivo Villages, where they're looking at a target of a two-month turnover to get folks into housing. That means we have a pretty healthy stock of a shelter that is specifically designed to meet the needs of folks who are unsheltered, that should have, and Aviva, one of our most trusted providers, have done incredible work housing this population in the past, that should have a healthy enough flow that we are able to continually bring new people inside there and then connect them on into housing. So we expect that to offset the kind of the usual growth in summer, and certainly the dramatic growth we saw last year. So we think we have measures that will dampen any growth effects that we see in the summer, but I don't think we can discount its possibility entirely. Looking a little bit further out, it's really about those exits to homelessness and entries to homelessness. And if we can get more deeply affordable housing online along the lines of Stephen Square, then we can really start driving these numbers down and projecting that out.
Thank you, Mr. Hewitt. Ms. Willey-Ayers, did you have anything that you wanted to add?
Madam Chair, I would just briefly add our rough numbers we've taken from the University of Minnesota Law Center. Are estimating as many as 5,000 eviction filings in the first month moratorium lifts in Hennepin alone. Again, I think if those could be filing notices instead of filings, that would go a long way. But we are currently, we opened Hennepin's Emergency Rent Assistance Program with new federal funds on March 5th. We're on our way to being able to support 3,000 renters, before April. So our goal with these new federal funds and then the new $21 billion that just was approved and any new assistance from the state is to help renters catch up as much as possible. So like Mr. Hewitt said, we're keeping people out of shelter.
Thank you very much. Representative Hornstein.
Just very quick follow-up because I know we're running on short on time, but Mr. Hewitt, you had mentioned the Avivo. I think maybe quick reference on the indoor villages. Can you give us a quick update on where are we at with that program? I know that was a really excellent and quick turnaround from a concept to actually the infrastructure there in the warehouse district in Minneapolis or the north of that. How is that facility doing? And is there capacity there? Is that running at capacity?
Mr. Hewitt?
Thank you, Representative, for the question. Yes, it's a very exciting project. We are getting attention nationally for a model that is really unique in the way that it was developed in community and what it offers to people. The project initially opened for a small group of people in December, so we took in 16 people directly from the streets at the end of December while there was still ongoing work to bring the whole site online and to scale, which also provided an opportunity for learning and engaging those folks in the further build-out. And in actual fact, I know that one of them at least has already moved into their own permanent home. So that obviously is the trajectory we want to see continue. March 8th, the site went fully live. So the full 100 self-contained units within the larger warehouse space were available. I'm sure many others on this call had the pleasure of touring the facility. It's pretty incredible. And what I heard last week from outreach teams was outreach teams are working with the Adult Shelter Connect to target, identify people who are long-term outside, the folks who were not coming inside to existing systems, and bring them inside. And the last I heard, that approximately 8 people per day were being brought in by outreach teams into that setting. So we expect, if it's not at full capacity now, that it will be very soon. And then the work ongoing will be to get those folks out into housing and create that flow to bring more people in. But this is really an incredible opportunity to work with folks who are long-term homeless, who've been part of our unsheltered population for a really long time, and finally resolve their issues with the wraparound services that are available.
And a big thank you for your work on that. And thank you, Madam Chair, for your work on that.
Thank you so much, Representative Hornstein. Anything further? Or Representative Hornstein, are you good?
Oh, thank you. I'm good. Thank you.
Okay, perfect. We're going to finish up for the week. I really appreciated, it was really useful to me and I think to the other members of the committee to hear from, what our local partners are doing on the ground. While we were in the committee, Representative Cagle and I were texting and she's like, oh, I would love to hear from Anoka County, which is the county that she represents. And so, I think, and as I mentioned at the beginning of our time together, I don't know that we heard kind of more from urban core cities and St. Louis County, which is sort of mostly Duluth. So I think it would be great if members want to, for us to have maybe another session like this or another, hear from a couple other counties moving forward. But it was really helpful for me today. Representative New Brindley, did you have anything before we adjourn?
Yeah, just quickly, Madam Chair, I appreciate it, and I think we've all appreciated the committee. I'm wondering if you can give us some idea of what your intentions are for the committee moving forward. I think probably we're primarily done hearing bills. I'm just wondering on what your plans are for the meeting moving forward.
Absolutely. Thank you for asking. So I guess, you know, in this committee, I feel like we've done a lot of like kind of table setting, but to me, that work is ongoing. And so, you know, I met with Kathy Tenbrook and Eric Grumdahl about some of the issues that they might want to bring up. I anticipate us continuing to meet. You know, there are a couple of bills that we're going to hear on an informational basis. And other than that, you know, Representative New Brindley, I would love for us to have another time to talk about finances, at least, right, to dig in more to, you know, that really complicated chart spreadsheet thing that we got. And, you know, and I'm going to connect with you offline if there are other things that you think it would be helpful to cover. I would love to hear from any members of the committee that have thoughts. I know that, you know, Representative Heinrich and I visited before the committee started, and there were some programs that he was interested in maybe having us hear from. So I'm open to all of that, but I plan for us to continue our work, you know, because we have, again, you know, we have to kind of do a lot of definition as we're moving into our next year, continuing to work on policy. So.
Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you so much. With that, we are adjourned.